You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, who are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 100 by Rudolf Steiner. The book is entitled True Knowledge of the Christ, composed of two cycles. I am on the first cycle. 14 lectures entitled Theosophy and Rosicrucianism, translated by Anna Mois. This is Lecture 13. Given in Kassel on the 28th of June, 1907. Today and tomorrow, my aim will be to show you the way to the higher worlds that is particularly suitable for the present time. It has been cultivated in occult training, as it is called, especially from the 14th and 15th centuries, and is the most suitable for modern humanity. We'll find it easier to understand what this is about if we first take a look at the future evolution of humanity. We have spoken of human evolution through the Saturn, Sun, Moon, and Earth states. It is difficult for someone whose thinking is wholly in the here and now to think of how one might know something about the future. But you must understand that some major laws will apply just as much in future as they do now. Anyone who is familiar with these laws can take a look into the future. In the field of material reality, no one will doubt today that it is possible to predict things, calculating eclipses of the sun and moon and other stellar events far into the future, for instance. No one will be in doubt about this anymore in the field of material reality. Everyone also knows that when you speak of particular substances being brought together in a retort, it will be possible for a scientist to say what will happen when they are mixed. This kind of prophecy relates to external facts that can be perceived with the senses. One can prophesy because one knows the laws according to which the substances act. In the same way, we get to know the laws in spiritual science according to which human life proceeds, and it is therefore possible to know something in advance that will happen in future. People will, of course, raise an objection at this point, one which philosophers have raised through the ages. It is that if we are able to foresee what will happen, there will be no chance for human freedom. What is happening here is that people confuse foreseeing future events with predetermination. You will therefore find the oddest thing said about this in all philosophies, for all philosophers have been unable to make that distinction. Except for Jacob Boehme, really. Let me give you an example to illustrate this. I want to compare time with space. Consider yourself to be standing here, and two people standing out there in the street. You see what they are doing from a distance. Does this also make you the person who is to say what they should do? No, you see it, but the two people are perfectly free to act. The fact that you are watching them does not govern anything they do. Consider the clairvoyant now, who sees what will happen in future. If those events were determined by the future, which is fixed already at the present time, this would not mean seeing into the future. You will only clearly understand the distinction if you think for a long time about the difference between predetermination and prescience. Today I do not really want to tell you how things will be on Earth when the Jupiter and Venus times have been reached. I want to tell you something else that will give you a picture for human evolution toward the future. I want to present something to you that comes from the earliest Christian mysteries, from the same Christian school of the real Dionysius, as a doctrine that has always been taught in esoteric Christian schools. They would start from the following comparison. I am talking to you here. You hear my words. You hear the thoughts that are in my mind, thoughts which I might also keep hidden from you by not putting them in words. When I say some word here, the air in this room moves. My words do every time set up waves in the air. The whole body of air vibrates according to the way in which the words are spoken. Now, let us now take this a bit further. Imagine you were able to make the air liquid and then solid. It is actually possible to make air solid today. You know that water may exist as vapor, that it can cool down and then be liquid, and that it may be solid when it is frozen. Consider me speaking the word God into the air. If you could make the air frozen at the moment when the sound waves are here, a form would drop down, the form of a shell, for instance. A different wave would drop down if the word, in quotes, world was said. You would be able to capture my words, and there would be a crystallized air form corresponding to every word. This was an actual example given in the Christian schools. Something is first a spoken word, then it grows solid, turning into a solid form. Earlier, before it became solid, it was a thought hidden within the speaker. The Christian would then think, quote, creation in the world at large is like the creative act here in this room. It started from the thought of things. Then the divine spirit spoke the thought into space. The plants and minerals you see out there are such divine words grown solid. You could think of everything resolved into the sound waves of the divine world word. I see the word of God grown solid in everything I see. Close quote. This is what the Christian would say to himself, and he would make distinction in a certain respect between the Father who is hidden, who has not yet uttered the word, or the Son sounding through space, and then the world grown solid, the revelation. You thus gain a deep understanding of the beginning of John's Gospel. Quote, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. It was in the beginning with God. Through it, everything entered into existence, and without it, nothing entered into existence. Close quote. Everything that has come into existence has arisen from the Word. We must take things as literally as possible, and then we will easily recognize the creative nature of the Word or Logos. In Christian terms, this word or logos comes in second place. Logos must not be translated as anything but word, for the way it is meant is that the unuttered creative word is behind all creation out there, that it sounded out as word, and that in it lies the source and origin of all that is. If we were to go back far enough in the course of time, we would hear all things we know as animals, plants, minerals, human beings, sound through cosmic space as word, just as you hear my words today. For the air had then not cooled down enough for them to drop down as figures and forms. If you keep that in mind, you'll be able to say to yourself, quote, the human being is a beginner today compared to what his forebears were doing, the gods that were above him. There was a time when the gods spoke the word into space. And then this creative activity became creation, everything we have around us. Anything we are able to produce in the plant, animal, and human worlds by sexual reproduction is but a changed form, deriving from that creator word of old. Human beings have a higher and a lower nature in them. The most finished aspect has the sexual element in it. And human beings have the beginnings of a new way of procreating in their larynx. When they send out the word, it is a beginning of what they will achieve at a later time. The human being is today just beginning with the work that the gods once did. The old way of procreating will be replaced with something else. And where human beings produce words with their larynx today, the larynx will one day be a generative organ. It will produce ever higher, ever denser creations. What is mere air today will in future be an entity, a spirit. When the earth has changed into Jupiter, the word will be creative in the mineral world. At the Venus stage, the larynx will bring forth plants. And that is how it will continue until man will be able to reproduce himself. Man only arose in the form we have today when he was able to send out air from his lungs to be sound outside. Things we can today only say to ourselves, we will be able to produce in such a way at future stages of earth evolution that it will persist. And ultimately the larynx will be the organ by which human beings can reproduce themselves in purity with no sexuality. They will then have reconfigured their larynx into an organ of procreation. We get a glimpse of what the future human being will be like and the potential that lies in the larynx. A puzzling phenomenon can give a pointer to the way in which the life of the larynx is connected with certain developmental states. In the male gender, sexual maturity also means that the voice breaks. The larynx is in its beginnings, sexuality at its end. Such subtle connections exist between things in the natural world. Our sexual life is dying. Our larynx, our word, will in future be an organ to reproduce ourselves. We might refer to many other things to show how human beings will gradually develop the organs which today exist only in their beginnings, which we have made our own as our breathing system on earth, though this does belong to the system of the heart. Let us now see how, with the training that has been introduced in Europe from the 14th century, we can indeed anticipate further states of humanity. How one can also make one's inner development go faster than if one simply gives oneself up to the course that the world is taking. The training, which we call Rosicrucianism, is something which has really got a bad name with people who have only once heard of it. If what the books say and scholars know about it were true, Rosicrucianism would be no more than the fraud which it is said to be. But the truth is that the people who judge Rosicrucianism in that way do in fact only know the fraud. We will consider the genuine Rosicrucianism today, which came into existence through the individual who hides behind the name Christian Rosenkreutz, and who initiated the Rosicrucian movement in 1459. Let me say emphatically that what I am saying has been selected as an example, just as I said yesterday with regard to the Christian training. I will, therefore, give you the 7 main points of Rosicrucian training straight away. Not everyone goes through them in the same sequence, but we'll begin by listing these stages which apply to everyone with regard to Rosicrucianism. The first stage is called study. Gaining insight in images comes second. The third is reading the occult or secret script. The fourth is preparing the philosopher's stone. The fifth is what is called correspondence between the small world, the microcosm, and the large world, the macrocosm. The sixth is living with the macrocosm. And the seventh is called being in harmony with God. The Rosicrucian way is the one which takes one in the most certain and profound way to insight into Christianity. However, the Christian way is more suited to those who are able to stay firm in the faith and are able to bring the feelings of which I spoke yesterday inwardly to life. The Rosicrucian way is more for those who are able to connect the Christian truths with the truths of the outside world. It is exactly in this case that Christianity can be defended against any attack from outside. Christianity is a philosophy of life, where one can never be wise enough to understand it adequately. There is no degree high enough to fully understand how Christianity exists for the most wise among the wise. But the Rosicrucian way is the one most suitable for people today. We, in quotes, study, in the Rosicrucian sense, when we have thoughts that have nothing at all to do any more with the world we perceive through the senses. In the Western world, people really only know, quote, thinking in free thought, close quote, when doing geometry. Christian Gnostic schools therefore also used the term, quote, mathesis, close quote, for something that referred to the higher truths, to God and the higher worlds. For these must be seen free from all sensuality, just as mathematics must also be seen to be free from all sensuality. A circle drawn with a piece of chalk is most imperfect. The true circle exists only in thought, and everything you are able to learn about the circle can only be thought. It is exactly in mathematics that you learn to think in a way that is independent of the senses, learning from the circle that you construct in your thoughts, from a mentally constructed triangle, its angles adding up to 360 degrees. It is not all that comfortable to learn to think without the things we perceive outside. And for most people, the only field of study for this is theosophy. Readers aside, there's clearly an error here, talking about a triangle and its angles adding up to 360 degrees. No way that was said by Steiner, so it must have just been a typo in the book. End of readers aside. As I told you in our very first session, theosophical knowledge is perfectly logical, but anyone wanting to find the truths for himself will need to be clairvoyant. Logic is, however, enough for insight. Computing machines, which do not teach us to learn independently of the senses, could only be the fruit of our materialistic age. Yet the very thing which children must learn is to grasp things without recourse to the senses. It will be particularly and tremendously valuable for education to bring in the influence of insight in the spirit. Spiritual science actually is good training in thinking without recourse to the senses. For everything I have been telling you about Saturn's sun, about the levels of human existence, is something you cannot see. You have to grasp it in thoughts free from sensuality. And no one should think that they can train well unless they first grasp things in theory. That is indeed the good thing, that these things do not exist for the sensual approach. For we then learn a way of thinking that goes beyond sensuality. It will therefore be enough for many that they first simply enter into what theosophy tells about the things which one cannot grasp with the senses. Essentially, those have also always been the thoughts presented to people in the Rosicrucian schools, and they were made to impress those thoughts thoroughly in their memory. If you want to go further, you'll find a good way of learning pure thinking in my books titled Truth and Science, or Truth and Knowledge, and titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity, also called The Philosophy of Freedom, also called Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path. These books are sheer mental gymnastics, free from sensuality. With other books, you will not, as a rule, make much of a change if you move a thought to a different place. With these books, the thoughts cannot be put in a different place. These books came about in that my person merely provided the opportunity for these thought edifices to be made perceptible to the senses. One simply had to give oneself up so that these thoughts generated themselves, extended themselves. Anyone who wants to go into them more deeply and give half a year to them, it is not easy, but this effort and what can be achieved in this way is the best of all things, and read them right through, will have drawn on a power in himself that has so far been hidden. The second thing is imagination, insight gained in images. And this is wholly in the light of the beautiful words of Goethe, quote, "All that must pass away is but a parable," close quote. Only those who have gained certainty in their thinking should really do this. Otherwise, one might easily give in to fantasy. The precondition is, therefore, that one has, first, become a clear thinker. Nothing is more likely to prevent aberration than clear thinking. And nothing is more likely to lead us astray than lack of clear thinking, lack of logic. In the wider sense, we might say that with imagination, you look at everything around you the way you look at a person. Look at a person's face. You see lines, creases develop and disappear again. You do not merely describe them, but call them smile or sadness. The human smile tells you of a cheerful inner mood. You do not just draw conclusions from outer appearance as to inner life. It actually is a sign for you of an inner life. Or you see a tear develop. You're not just a physicist who judges a tear merely according to the law of gravity, but you know that the teardrop reflects some sadness in the soul. All outward things are thus a reflection of the inner mood of soul to you. And the Rosicrucian pupil enters into a mood where everything he sees outside does, in the same way, reflect for him the earth spirit, let us say. A certain plant, the autumn crocus, in reality, becomes a reflection for him of mournful earthly existence. Other plants, a reflection of cheerful earthly existence. Just as a smiling face reflects a cheerful mood, so do the flowers reflect for him the earth's cheerful or sad mood. Goethe was not just referring to an outward image when he spoke of the earth spirit in his Faust, quote, "In life, like a flood, in deeds like a storm, up and down I flow. Birth and the grave, an eternal wave, turning, returning, a life ever burning. Thus I work on time's whirring wheel. God's living garment I weave and reveal." Close quote. The earth spirit gradually became something to him that lives in the earth, and he developed a relationship in mind and soul to the whole of nature around him. Let me quite specifically tell you of one mood. The Rosicrucian pupil would walk through the fields, and see the small dewdrops on all plants. He had to recall ancient Niflheim, home of mists, then, where the air was full of dewy mists, and where human beings related to the natural world in a very different way. Walking through the fields and meadows, the Rosicrucian pupil would say to himself, quote, in ancient Niflheim, this was dissolved in the air atmosphere, close quote, and a profound memory would arise in him of Atlantean times. Imagination was taken to a particularly high level for the pupils of medieval Rosicrucian schools, and also by those who were pupils of the Holy Grail. I'll put that teaching in the form of a dialogue, being unable to formulate it in any other way. The teacher would say to the pupil, quote, look at the plant as it sprouts from the ground, how it opens the calyx with the organs of fertilization, and how the sun's rays come down, get the flower to open and the fruit to ripen. Close quote. The pupils of Rosicrucianism and those of the Holy Grail had to call this image, this idea, to mind. Even in materialistic science, we find something that is highly significant, which is that the plant is compared to the human being. But you would have to compare the root to the head, and the flower with the organs of fertilization in human beings, something they hide in shame. The root is the plant's head. The human being is an inverted plant. An animal is only a half-inverted plant. The Rosicrucians would therefore say, quote, look at the plant, its root in the soil, its organs of fertilization chastely held out to the sun. Look at the animal, its spine horizontal, and then the human being, completely transformed. Plant, animal, and man, in their evolution, symbolized by the cross. The cross is plant, animal, and man. Close quote. We will now understand Plato's words. Quote, the world's soul is stretched on the cross of the world. Close quote. The soul of the world, which fills everything, is stretched out across plant, animal, and man. So, the Rosicrucian pupil would be exhorted, quote, look at the plant. Of its kind, it is lower than you are. It does not yet have conscious awareness and power of thought, but its substance is pure and chaste. It holds up its calyx to the sun, extending its organs of reproduction toward the sun, without want or desire to the sun's ray, the sacred lance of love. Now, however, matter is being filled with desire. Do create the idea for the future in your mind that matter will be cleansed again, that it reproduces in pure chastity. Close quote. And this attention would be drawn to the larynx, where human beings will have regained the chastity of the calyx in purity. Quote, think of the calyx of the plant. It is still free from desire. It goes through desires it develops, but will be pure again, bringing forth again in chastity, letting itself be fertilized by the sun's ray, which has been made spiritual, the sacred lance of love. Close quote. The portent of this sacred lance of love was the lance used to pierce the heart of Christ Jesus on the cross. Yesterday we saw how this blood from the Redeemer's wound banished egotism from the earth. That lance was, therefore, a portent for the higher lance, which is the sun's ray made spiritual. And the Holy Grail points to humanity's chalice, which evolves from the larynx and will be the great reproductive organ of the future, as it is with plants today. That is the deeper concept of the Holy Grail. And this was made clear to pupils at the imagination level of their initiation. Take the images you now have before you, Calyx of the plant, sexuality immersed in desire, holy grail, calyx or chalice free from desire, and compare them with the dry, sober, rational concept provided in modern science. This gives you the difference between imagination and mere rational thinking, all cosmic events seen in images. This is important because mere rational concepts of the kind people have today are not creative. These images are truly creative for those who bring the concepts together in an image. People felt this in earlier times, and it must be taken into account when raising children. I'd like to discuss a current issue at this point. People are much inclined to say, quote, "Think of the silly things our forefathers taught us when we were children. The story of the stork bringing babies, for instance. Today we have to tell children the truth." Close quote. If our descendants are going to treat us the way we treat our ancestors, they will laugh at us and say, quote, "Our ancestors thought that human beings came into existence through material interaction." Close quote. And they'll consider the time when people explained this to children in a spiritual way. The ancestors believed in the stork story themselves when it first came up, for they knew full well that when someone is born, the soul comes down from the spiritual world. They would always connect it with something that had wings. You'll also find it in children's songs today, like the song, quote, "Fly, lady bird, fly. Your father is in the war. Your mother is in Podgeland. Podgeland has burned down. Fly, lady bird, fly." Close quote. Fly is meant as an image for the human soul, for people still had an inkling of astral space, of bodies that were flying there and came into the physical world from there. And, quote, Podgeland, close quote. Podge is nothing but the name for an infant, and Podgeland is the land of the children where the mother goes to fetch her infant. We merely have to explain it wholly in terms of the spiritual world. If you then recall that this image of the stork bringing babies is an image for a spiritual process for reincarnation, you will see how tremendously important it is that people first take in things in images. For their state of mind will be very different if we teach children first the image for the spiritual process, so that they will then hear of the physical process in holy awe. You yourselves will be able to believe in the stork again if you know that this stork is an image you have for the soul flying down. Your teaching will give wings to the child's powers of imagination. And if you perceive the truth, a mysterious aura will come from this and be transmitted to the child. That is how it is with all things seen in images. You can teach the children anything. If the question to be considered is about life after death, you take the child to see a butterfly chrysalis. As the butterfly flies from the chrysalis, so does the soul fly from the body, only that we don't see it. But you'll only speak to the child with conviction if you believe it yourself, and the emergence of the butterfly from the chrysalis is the same, though at a lower level, as what happens to the soul at a higher level. When spiritual knowledge takes people again into understanding the spiritual world so that images live in their hearts, children will be brought up in a very different way again, and not given the dry intellectual truths that coarsen the mind. We must not, however, make it grotesque or comical, but understand clearly the important aspects of life that are behind it. The third thing to be acquired, so as to pave the way, is, quote, "getting to know the occult script," close quote. This does not mean learning a script the way we do in ordinary life. the characters of our alphabet, do in many ways go back to occult images, but they are far removed from what we call the occult script. There we have a way of finding one's way into the genuine great powers that come into play out there in the world. Everything we record there has to be such that one developmental process leaps to the next. Take a plant. It bears seed. In the seed, you have the starting point for a new plant. But if you were really able to see into the whole process, you'd see that nothing of the old plant becomes part of the new one. In reality, the whole of the old plant perishes as far as matter is concerned. The new plant is completely new as it develops. There is just a process of movement evolving the new plant. Here you have sealing wax, and here a seal. You press the seal into the wax, but no part of the seal remains in the wax. Only the form is transferred. That is how it is with every development process. The old matter, as it is dying, merely provides occasion for the new form to rise again in the manner of the old one. This is represented as two intertwined spirals, which never come together. This kind of transition came after Atlantean civilization. It disappeared, and a new one arose as the Indian civilization. This, too, would need to be shown as two spirals. I have told you that in the year 800, the sun rose roughly in the sign of the ram, before that in the bull, even earlier in the twins, and before that in Cancer. Greco-Roman civilization, which held the beginning of ours in it, was at the time when the sun rose in the ram. The preceding civilization, the Chaldean, Assyrian, Babylonian, and Egyptian, came at the time when the sun rose in the sign of the bull. Before that you have the Persian civilization, which was at the time when the sun rose in the twins. The ancient Indian civilization evolved when the sun was in Cancer, and that was when the sign of Cancer, the two intertwined spirals, was first written. I could explain the true meaning of every sign of the zodiac to you in this way. The signs have been created out of the natural world and reflect the powers and laws at work out there in nature. Getting to know the occult characters, one begins to go out of oneself and penetrate the hidden roots of the natural world. Thus you have the first three stages of the Rosicrucian path briefly outlined. Study, insight in images, and thirdly, learning the occult script. Tomorrow we'll consider the other stages, starting with, quote, preparing the philosopher's stone, close quote, the end of lecture 13.